would help me to operate rationally and effectively, despite my bulky wiring. Once again, it helps to know thyself and to adapt thyself accordingly. As I've mentioned, one of my flaws is that I'm amazingly easy to distract, and I need to address this problem in designing my physical environment. Unlike Buffett, who can operate brilliantly without a computer or an email address, I rely on my computer. But I'm also aware that the internet and email can become appalling distractions for me. To counteract this and to help me remain focused, I physically divided my office. At one end of the corridor, I have a busy room with a phone, a computer, and four monitors, but I keep the computer and the monitors on an adjustable height desk, which I typically position so that I have to stand beside it. Responding to emails is a low mental task, but it's easy to get sucked into it for long stretches of time, so I've intentionally set up the desk in a way that prevents me from sitting at it. This might seem perverse, but the goal is to create an office that gives me the space to think quietly and calmly. Minor adjustments like this awkward positioning of the computer help to stack the odds in my favor. At the other end of the corridor, I have a room that I call the library. Here, there's no phone or computer. I want to encourage myself to spend more time sitting and thinking, so this room is designed to be warm and welcoming. I can take piles of financial documents to study in there, or select a book from the shelves that line the walls. If I close the door, it means that nobody is allowed to bother me. The library also serves as a nap room. Not coincidentally, Monish also naps in his office, and Warren told us that he has a place in his office where he can nap too. This isn't a matter of sloth, or at least not entirely. A daytime snooze keeps the mind fresh, shuts out the noise, and provides a chance to reboot the system. Trivial as it might seem, even the way you decorate your office matters. Think of Oxford colleges, where the dining halls are adorned with portraits of illustrious alumni. On some level, their presence sends an inspiring message to the current flock of students. In a similar way, I positioned a bronze bust of Charlie Munger in my office. I'm not deifying him, but I want to activate his presence in my mind, not least as a cue to remind me of the dangers of those 24 forms of misjudgment that he identified in his talk at Harvard. Likewise, I keep photographs in my busy room and my library that show me with Warren and Monish on the day of our lunch. I can't explain all of this on a rigorous scientific level, but my impression is that mirror neurons help us to model the influential people in our presence. By having images of Munger and Buffett in my office, I'm trying once again to tilt the playing field on a subconscious level, using their presence to influence my thoughts. My sense is that this is quite common. When I visited Winston Churchill's study at Chartwell, I was struck by the objects he kept on his desk, including a bust of Napoleon, a porcelain figurine of Admiral Nelson, and a photograph of the South African Prime Minister Jan Smuts. I don't think they were there merely for decoration. I'm guessing there were moments when Churchill would ask himself what these famous leaders would do in his situation. Religious objects such as crucifixes can presumably serve a similar purpose, providing a cue for the devout to improve their behavior. Given the power of mirroring, it's important to choose our heroes and role models with real care. I also have photographs in my office of my father and some of my first investors, including a couple of his business partners. This is to remind me who I'm working for, so that I never lose sight of my responsibility to my shareholders. Lately, I've been thinking of commissioning a single photographer to take black and white portraits of all my investors. About a year after our charity lunch, Warren Buffett generously gave Monish and me an impromptu tour of his office in Omaha. I was fascinated to see how he had structured his own environment to enhance his ability to make rational decisions. Perhaps the most striking feature of his office was that it contained so little that could clutter his mind. He had only two chairs and no space for large meetings, a practical means of discouraging unnecessary interactions. His window shades were closed, presumably helping him to focus on the task at hand. On the wall behind his desk, Warren had a prominently displayed photo of his father, Howard Buffett, whom he greatly admires. Lowenstein's biography of Warren describes Howard as an unshakably ethical congressman who refused offers of junkets and even turned down a part of his pay. During his first term, when the congressional salary was raised from $10,000 to $12,500, Howard left the extra money in the Capitol Disbursement Office, insisting that he had been elected at the lower salary. It's not hard to see this influence on Warren, whose modest salary for running Berkshire reflects a similar sense of integrity and altruism. More to the point, the photo is a reminder of how helpful it can be to include images of our role models when we are constructing our own work environment. As for Warren's desk, it was so small that there was no room for piles, obliging him to process his reading efficiently. An inbox and an outbox lay on top of his desk, along with a box labeled "Too Hard," a visual reminder that he should wait patiently until the perfect opportunity arrives. As he puts it, "I will only swing at pitches I really like." There's an element of playfulness about his "too hard" box, but its presence must also have a subtle effect on the way he thinks. These cues wouldn't help much if Buffett didn't also have an extraordinary mind, but it's interesting that even a man of his intelligence sees fit to keep that box on his desk as a physical aid that keeps his mind on track. To me, this shows a remarkable humility about his abilities. I also found it telling that there was no Bloomberg terminal in Buffett's office. Apparently there's one at the other end of the building, used by a Berkshire employee who manages a bond portfolio. Buffett could no doubt access it if he wanted to, but he's consciously chosen not to have this informational fire hose within easy reach. Likewise, when I visited Nick Sleep's office in London, I was intrigued to discover that he kept his Bloomberg awkwardly positioned so that he could use it only while sitting on an uncomfortably low chair. Like Buffett, he had consciously designed his environment to discourage his use of a terminal that costs more than $20,000 a year to rent. Why? After all, a constant flow of information is surely the lifeblood of any professional investor. My own relationship with the Bloomberg terminal is similarly ambivalent and tortured. It's a formidable tool, and there are times when I've found it helpful as a way to get stock data or news in a hurry. In my New York Vortex years, my Bloomberg subscription also served the dubious purpose of bolstering my ego. It made me feel like a privileged member of a club that could afford the most expensive toys. Without it, I might not have felt equal to my peer group. But beyond this foolishness, there's also a more serious downside to using a Bloomberg, or for that matter, rival systems sold by companies like Reuters and FactSet. All of these products, but especially the coveted top-of-the-line Bloomberg, are ingeniously designed to lure the subscriber with a seductive promise of non-stop information. The terminal delivers such a relentless flood of news and data into investors' brains that it's hard to muster the self-discipline to turn off the spigot and concentrate on what matters most. You see stock tickers flashing before your eyes, news alerts blaring for your attention. Everything links to something else, so you often find yourself ricocheting into deeper and deeper recesses within this informational netherworld. Initially, I was totally hooked. In my early years as a money manager, I would arrive in my Manhattan office and immediately fire up my Bloomberg. It would light up like a Christmas tree, its bright colors subconsciously spurring its users to action. But as I became more self-aware, I began to realize that this call to action wasn't helping me at all, nor were the endless hours of information surfing. I started to ask myself, is this really the best and highest use of my attention? If I only have a limited amount of willpower, how much of it should I squander in trying to resist the temptation to snack on all this informational sugar? During the financial crisis, I saw more clearly than ever what an unhealthy addiction the Bloomberg had become. The constant barrage of bad news could easily have exacerbated my irrational tendencies, when what I needed most was to screen out the noise and focus on the long-term health of my portfolio. So I went cold turkey. In late 2008 and early 2009, as the market collapsed, I turned the monitor off for days on end. Another tactic that I used to distance myself from the Bloomberg was to stop having a personal login, though we still had a company login. I also changed the color scheme on my home screen so that it was dull and muted, thereby minimizing the risk that all those bright flashing colors might jolt my irrational brain into unnecessary action. In setting up my office in Zurich, I had to decide once again how to tackle the Bloomberg conundrum. By now I was used to having the service. Psychologically, it would have been painful to let it go. I also knew that occasionally it was extraordinarily useful, but I was equally aware that, for me, it did more harm than good. So in the end, I came to an uneasy compromise. I relegated the Bloomberg to the adjustable height desk in my busy room. The fact that the desk is adjusted so that I usually have to stand means that there's little danger that I'll be tempted to use the Bloomberg for hours, grazing in a state of helpless distraction. Nowadays, I often go weeks without turning on the Bloomberg at all. Still, it's there if I ever need it. My own exceptionally expensive version of a toddler's security blanket. Of course, the rational part of my brain tells me that I'd be better off getting rid of the Bloomberg entirely. Why bother paying more than $20,000 a year for a distraction that I can so easily do without? But I accept my fallibility. Instead of pretending to be perfectly rational, I find it more helpful to be honest with myself about my irrationality. At least then I can take practical steps that help me to manage my irrational self. Perhaps this is the best that any of us can do. Chapter 9. Learning to Tap Dance. A New Sense of Playfulness. In moving to Zurich, I decided that I needed to change other aspects of my life too. It wasn't just a matter of constructing an environment that would help me to be more rational, less distracted, and calmer. I wanted to alter my attitude to life itself. The experiences of 2008 to 2009 were so heightened and intense that it had been difficult for me to remain in balance. This is one of the biggest challenges for investors. We all know that it's important to be physically healthy, to have a satisfying personal life, and to maintain some kind of emotional equilibrium. But this holistic perspective is not just an airy-fairy New Age dream. The truth is that it's hard to invest well if your non-investing life is out of whack, in chaos, or stunted. Great investors don't often talk publicly about their emotional challenges, but George Soros gave some sense of the stresses of investing when he wrote that there were moments when he wasn't sure if he was running his fund or if his fund was running him. By contrast, Buffett has said that he tap dances to work every morning. His playfulness and zest for life are reflected in his sense of humor and his love of bridge. He has found his passions and he delights in them. I wanted to inject more joy in my own life, to recapture the playfulness I had lost over the years. During the financial crisis, there were moments when my career seemed in real jeopardy. The market carnage was so extreme that countless funds went out of business. Even investors as famed as Bill Miller were mauled so badly that their reputations were severely damaged. One of the cleverest investors I knew, a guy from the year above me at Harvard, lost 80% and had to close his fund. He was still in his early 40s, but his once glittering career as an investor was apparently finished. For me, the crash was the investing equivalent of a near-death experience. It forced me to reappraise how I wanted to live and what was truly important to me. Amid this soul-searching, I began to see that I had locked myself into a view of my career as a life-or-death struggle. My approach was simply too extreme. I didn't just want to be a great investor, but to be Warren Buffett. For so many years, I had driven myself in an almost maniacally focused way to achieve my goals, acting as if my exam results, my university performance, and my fund's investment returns were everything, as if they defined who I was and determined my value. Perhaps this stemmed from the ethos of my English education. At the age of 11, I had gone to a British boarding school as an immigrant misfit who had already lived in Iran, Israel, and South Africa. Everything at school was a struggle for me, and I felt at the time that it was all about survival. In a sense, I carried this attitude blindly into my adult life, seeing my investing career as a kind of gladiatorial contest. In the wake of the financial crisis, I belatedly recognized that this tendency to approach life as a battle to the death was not necessarily useful, let alone a recipe for happiness. I needed to lighten up. Figuratively, at least, I wanted to learn to tap dance. As part of this reinvention of myself, I was determined to have a lot more fun. One aspect of this was that I began to travel more. In 2009, for example, I took a 10-day trip to India with Monish. In the past, I would never have embarked on an adventure like this. I had felt obliged to work non-stop, so I would have convinced myself that I needed to stay home and watch over my stock portfolio. But I went to India with no agenda, and it turned out to be a marvelously enriching experience, helping me to see the world anew. Among other things, I got to observe the remarkable work that Monish's Dakshana Foundation is doing to help educate kids on an industrial scale. It might sound like a platitude, but it also affected me deeply to see how happy many people were in India, despite having so little on a purely material level. It helped me to recognize how twisted our values can become in richer countries. And then there was the fascination of watching Monish in a non-professional setting, of seeing up close how he's wired. For me, there were lessons simply from observing his reaction to missed appointments and to people who behaved badly. I've seldom encountered anybody with his blend of calm and rational equanimity. On that same trip, we also attended a TED India conference in Mysore. I loved it. In the years that followed, I co-founded the TEDx Zurich conference, attended events like the Art Basel show in Switzerland, and got more involved with supporting institutions such as Oxford, Harvard, and the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel. I don't know if these things have made me a better investor, but they have certainly broadened my thinking, brought me many interesting relationships, and invigorated my life. Equally important, these activities are another aspect of being true to myself and who I am. Meanwhile, in Zurich, I consciously avoided certain types of people. As I've mentioned, living in Switzerland and basing myself outside the city centre made it harder for the wrong people to visit me. They needed a good reason to make the effort, and this acted as a useful filtering mechanism. Moving to Zurich also allowed me to cut through the whole Gordian knot of my unhealthy relationships with fund marketers, equity analysts, and other professional helpers who had unhelpfully oriented me toward a standard New York hedgy model of life. But I wasn't looking to become a shut-in. On the contrary, I was increasingly willing to invest large amounts of time and money to travel anywhere to see people who were important to me. I went to Israel with Ken Shubenstein. I flew to California to spend a few days with Monish, again with no agenda other than the pleasure of hanging out with a person I like and admire. Monish and I also set up a mastermind group of 8 people, the Latticework Club, which meets every few months to share what's going on in our lives and to support one another. This group has helped me to open up emotionally and to introspect in a more systematic way. For good measure, I also teamed up with my friend John Mihaljevic to create an annual event in Switzerland called ValueX, a community of like-minded people who share investment ideas and wisdom, while also forging friendships over meals and on the ski slopes of Klosters. In 2014, more than 70 people flocked to Switzerland from around the world to join us at ValueX. I had always enjoyed sports, but after moving to Zurich, I embraced them with more enthusiasm than ever. I ran or biked a few days a week, and I took my kids skiing on weekends. Likewise, I rediscovered my love of games, not least because the financial crisis had given me a renewed appreciation for how important it is to be playful and not to take myself too seriously. I'd started to play bridge around 2007, prompted by Monish, who is an ardent player, and by the example of Buffett, Munger, and Bill Gates, all of whom are bridge fanatics. Initially, I joined the Manhattan Bridge Club and started taking lessons. Once I'd learned the basics, I quickly realized that bridge was not only a pleasurable diversion, but would help to hone my skills in life, not to mention investing. Indeed, as a preparation for investing, bridge is truly the ultimate game. If I were putting together a curriculum on value investing, bridge would undoubtedly be a part of it. As I began to discover the subtleties of the game, I was reminded of an intriguing comment that Charlie Munger had made about investing in his lecture on the causes of human misjudgment. "The right way to think is the way that Zeckhauser plays bridge. It's just that simple, and your brain doesn't naturally know how to think the way Zeckhauser knows how to play bridge." Richard Zeckhauser is a professor of political economy and a champion bridge player who chairs the Investment Decisions and Behavioral Finance Executive Program at Harvard. An expert on economic behavior in acutely uncertain situations, he has authored papers with titles like Investing in the Unknown and Unknowable. For investors, the beauty of bridge lies in the fact that it involves elements of chance, probabilistic thinking, and asymmetric information. When the cards are dealt, the only ones you can look at are your own. But as the cards are played, the probabilistic and asymmetric nature of the game becomes exquisite. For example, during the bidding, I might ask myself a question like this. Given that the player to my right has bid two clubs, how does that update my probabilistic assessment of what cards he's holding? As play continues, I might find myself thinking, aha, my partner has just led with the ace of spades. That must mean that she's also got a king or is short spades. In investing, we constantly operate with limited information. For example, not so long ago, Monish and I researched a Chinese manufacturer of cars and batteries, BYD Auto. What initially triggered our interest was a story in the Wall Street Journal which mentioned that Munger had liked the company and had spoken to Buffett about it. Warren then sent his top lieutenant at the time, David Sokol, to China. Shortly after that, Berkshire made an investment and Sokol joined BYD's board. As investors, we began to make probabilistic assessments about all of this public information. For example, we knew that Li Lu, who is Chinese-American, managed money for Munger. We had also read Munger's public comment that BYD's CEO, Wang Chuanfu, is a combination of Thomas Edison and Jack Welch, something like Edison in solving technical problems and something like Welch in getting done what he needs to do. I have never seen anything like it. In isolation, individual pieces of information like these don't count for that much, but they helped us to build a broader picture of what was going on and to update our knowledge of the company, prompting us to ask what Munger, Li Lu, Buffett, and Sokol might have seen in BYD that other investors had overlooked. I remember talking with Monish at the time and expressing my skepticism about the stock, given that this Chinese company lay outside my circle of competence. In the end, it took me more than a year to get comfortable enough to invest with real confidence that I understood the business. Monish, a more adept bridge player and a less risk-averse investor, was able to buy earlier than me because he was comfortable with the inferences he could draw from partial information. As he put it to me, it counted for a lot to know that Buffett, Munger, Sokol, and Li Lu all considered the stock a winner. Monish's willingness to act on incomplete information enabled him to buy BYD at a much lower price than I paid once the information was more complete. With my bridge hat on, I'm always searching for the underlying truth based on insufficient information. The game has helped me to recognize that it's simply not possible to have a complete understanding of anything. We're never truly going to get to the bottom of what's going on inside a company, so we have to make probabilistic inferences. This way of thinking proved particularly helpful after the credit crisis, when almost everybody detested American money center banks such as Citigroup, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan Chase. I studied them carefully, asking myself bridge-like questions such as, how on earth can I claim to understand the nuances of J.P. Morgan's $2 trillion balance sheet? The answer, I couldn't. More important, neither could J.P. Morgan's own management, at least not with great accuracy. But I could make useful probabilistic inferences about the bank's balance sheets and earning power. I asked myself, going forward, are these likely to be better or worse than other investors expect? Meanwhile, I read in the news that Buffett had just made a $5 billion investment in the preferred stock of Bank of America. Based on probabilistic thinking, this suggested to me that he believed the Fed was committed to ensuring that money center banks would be able to rebuild their balance sheets. Buffett's investment helped me to understand that the Fed was highly unlikely to raise interest rates until the banks were once again hugely profitable and healthy. For me, his weighing of these odds was revelatory. As Monish had pointed out, Buffett's involvement with banking stocks went back as far as 1969, and he'd almost never lost money on a bank bet. Given that nobody is a better investor in banks, Buffett's seal of approval meant a lot. For good measure, at least half of Bank of America's rivals had fallen by the wayside, leaving the company in an even stronger position. Smaller banks would struggle to compete, given the mounting costs of technology in the banking sector. And the legal risks facing the bank seemed lower than most people realized. After all, the litigation over the Exxon Valdez oil spill is still going on after 25 years, so it seems likely to us that the banking sector could drag out any lawsuits for many years, providing ample time to cover the potential cost of any claims. I ended up investing heavily in an array of money center banks whose stocks subsequently rebounded, much as Warren, Monish, and I had expected. My familiarity with bridge had helped me to become more adept at operating amid this kind of uncertainty. The key, perhaps, is that many investments are acutely uncertain, but not as risky as they might at first seem. People often assume that investors like me are great risk-takers, perhaps little more than gamblers. Certainly there are plenty of reckless investors with scant regard for the risk of loss, but they tend not to survive very long in the investing game. The long-term survivors possess a more sophisticated grasp of risk, including the ability to see when the situation is much less risky than the stock price might suggest. With J.P. Morgan Chase and the other money center banks, there was a lot of uncertainty, but a very little risk. Bridge wasn't the only game that captured my imagination or refined my mental habits. I also rediscovered the joys of chess, a wonderful game of analysis and pattern recognition. I first fell in love with chess at Harvard thanks to my classmate Mark Pincus, who later founded Zynga, a social gaming company that made him a billionaire. Back in our student days, Mark noticed an unused chess set in my dorm and asked me to play. He thrashed me. I bought a stack of chess books and we continued to play. I gradually got better and started to win some games. After graduating, I became a member of the Manhattan Chess Club and played pickup games in the park to escape from the horrors of my job at D.H. Blair. But my errant mind isn't quiet enough, so I've never become more than a half-decent player. Back then, I had no sense of why chess was useful, not just enjoyable. But over the years, I've come to see that there are real tactical benefits to understanding how such games work. For example, in chess, there's a set repertoire of opening tricks and mistakes that lead unsuspecting players to a quick demise, usually within the first few moves. Initially, when I fell into these traps, I felt angry with my opponent. It seemed like an underhanded way to win. Then I'd become angry with myself for missing what's known as a gotcha game. As I studied chess more, I became less prone to these basic mistakes. There are useful parallels in the game of investing. For example, accounting is full of gotcha gambits. Corporations often manipulate accounting rules to present their numbers in deceptive ways, and the unsuspecting investor is easily duped into thinking that the situation is less dangerous than it really is. In the late 90s, I analyzed a company that sold legal insurance. Like life insurance, this product was sold by brokers who received hefty commissions in return. The key to analyzing how profitable the firm really was lay in figuring out the correct rate at which to amortize the cost of acquiring its customers. This, in turn, was determined by how long those customers remained as clients after signing up. In my opinion, the company's accounts presented an overly sunny view of this, thus giving a misleading picture of the future. This struck me as the accounting equivalent of a gotcha game of chess, so I steered clear of the stock, which subsequently tumbled, triggering lawsuits and much hand-wringing among everyone except the short sellers, who had bet against the company on the basis of this dubious accounting. There was another way in which I found chess instructive. Early on, I had often found myself playing games against so-called duffers, a derisive term for players who make snap decisions based on emotions rather than on careful analysis. They either couldn't or wouldn't analyze the board in a considered manner. Initially, I often lost to the duffers. Their moves were so unpredictable that it would unnerve me and I'd lose my cool. But as I got better at the game, I became more disciplined, developing the mental fortitude to remain calm and careful, even while my opponent played with wild abandon. In the financial markets, plenty of investors, both amateur and professional, take foolhardy swings for the fences, betting on everything from hot tech stocks to overhyped IPOs. Sometimes these risky long shots pay off spectacularly, tempting other investors to follow their lead in making these duffer moves. But, as in chess, I've found that it ultimately works better to maintain my discipline and pursue a careful strategy with better odds of long-term success. In 2009, when many investors bailed out of stocks, they were once again making a classic duffer move. My opponent in that particular game wasn't an idiotic chess player, but the madness of Mr. Market. I knew that I simply had to keep my cool and use this madness to my advantage by buying stocks that the duffers were selling. I was also struck by the memorable mantra of a chess champion, Edward Lasker, who remarked, "When you see a good move, look for a better one." Applying this insight to stocks, I modified his mantra, often telling myself, "When you see a good investment, look for a better investment." Indeed, as Munger has pointed out, there's a common tendency to like a particular idea, whether it's a chess move or an investment, because it was the first one that popped into our heads. But is it really superior? Chess highlights the need to keep searching for a better move even after the brain has latched onto that first idea. Playing chess also strengthens this particular mental muscle. At the same time, I drew another fundamental lesson from my amateur adventures in the world of bridge and chess. Yes, it's true that these games taught me helpful tactical lessons and mental habits while reinforcing my understanding of how critical it is to control my emotions. But these games also taught me a simpler truth. After so many years of taking life too seriously, I needed to adopt a more playful attitude. So instead of seeing everything, including my work, as a form of mortal combat, I began to approach it in a different spirit, as if it were a game. I have no doubt that Mark Pincus had acted like this all along. As a lover of all sorts of games, he innately saw life as a game, and his playful attitude is an integral reason for his success. After Harvard, many of our classmates rushed to take dull positions at gold standard investment banks and consulting firms. There was a common but short-sighted feeling that the first job out of school was a life or death decision. In reality, these first jobs are often all but irrelevant given the direction that our careers later take. While many of our classmates had sewn up their plum jobs as much as a year before graduating, Mark had no clear sense of what he'd do on leaving Harvard. He looked instead for companies that simply caught his interest, where he could keep playing the game of life. As a result, he went to work for John Malone at TCI in a suburb of Denver, learning lessons about the communications industry that later proved invaluable. The moment a more compelling opportunity arose, he left to found his first company. When I visited him in San Francisco in those early days, he told me, "It's not about how much money you make, it's about changing the world." Steve Jobs took a similarly adventurous and playful approach to life. As he whimsically put it in his commencement speech at Stanford, "Stay foolish." Likewise, Buffett treats the investment business as a game and does little that compromises his day-to-day happiness. After surviving the financial crisis, I became more conscious of the benefits of this lighter, more playful approach. Following Warren's lead, I stopped forcing myself to do things that I didn't want to do. To this day, I work hard, but I work my own hours. If I want to take a nap during the day, I take a nap. In 2009, my fund had a fantastic year, thanks in large part to the stocks I'd bought during the crash. One business associate told me that I should go out and market myself, pounding the table to get more people to invest with me. I told him, "I don't want to. I want to have a happy life. I don't need to have the biggest fund." This attitude has undoubtedly made for a calmer and more joyful life, but I suspect it's also made me a better investor. To give you an analogy, when you drop a stone in a calm pond, you see the ripples. Likewise, in investing, if I want to see the big ideas, I need a peaceful and contented mind. This reminds me of a line that Monish often quotes from Blaise Pascal. "All of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone." Among the many gifts of my life in Zurich, none has been more important than my sense of quiet contentment. When I'm in this state, the right investment ideas have a way of bursting through to me. Surprisingly often, these ideas seize me while I'm on a bike ride or enjoying my life in some other way that's unconnected to the markets. That said, some of my professional investor friends are bemused when they see me heading off on trips to India and the like. One of them chided me, "Guy, these things won't contribute to your returns." I had to explain that I was no longer trying to be the greatest investor at all costs. My goal is no longer to be Warren Buffett, even if I could be. My real mission is to be a more authentic version of myself. At a recent annual meeting for my fund, someone in the audience asked me how I handle the process of selling stocks. I replied, "Badly." To some extent, I was being facetious, but I was also being lightheartedly honest because I don't believe that anyone handles the selling process particularly well. We can all claim to have clear rules, for example, declaring that a stock must be sold when it reaches 80% of its intrinsic value, but the truth is that this is an incredibly inexact science. There are stocks in my portfolio that, on a purely rational basis, I should probably sell, but I often hold on to them anyway. One reason is that I'm trying to manage myself, not just my portfolio, and I believe that my investment returns will be better over several decades if I master the trigger-happy side of my nature. More to the point, in confessing publicly that I'm not particularly good at selling, I was no longer trying to dazzle anybody with my brilliance or convince people to invest in my fund. I was more focused on giving an honest account of myself than on selling. If people want to invest alongside me and my family, I'm delighted. If not, I no longer feel the stab of rejection that I felt in the past. After all, this is not life and death. It's not mortal combat. But if I'm honest about it, there's still a deep-seated part of me that can never quite let go of the idea that money is a matter of survival. This is simply part of my wiring. Intellectually, I see the abundant benefits of viewing the stock market as a game, and I've no doubt improved as an investor by taking this more playful approach. But I also know that my shareholders' life savings are on the line. So investing may be a game, but for me, it's a deadly serious game. Chapter 10. Investing Tools. Building a Better Process. If ants can use a handful of simple rules to develop an infinitely complex survival strategy, what about investors? Can we create a similarly robust set of rules that will make our investment decisions smarter and less vulnerable to the distortions of our irrational brains? Here's one way to think about this. The human brain is said to run on about 12 watts. In other words, only a fifth of the power that's needed by a 60-watt light bulb. That's not much at all, given the power consumption of some of the computers that exist today. Yet we expect this relatively puny hardware to make immensely complex calculations about the investing world, and we even have the audacity to hope that we might get these calculations right. As we've discussed, one way to tilt the playing field to our advantage is to construct an environment in which we can operate more rationally, or at least less irrationally. But there's also another tool at our disposal. If we are looking to make better investment decisions, it helps immeasurably to develop a series of rules and routines that we can apply consistently. In the aftermath of the financial crisis, I worked hard to establish for myself this more structured approach to investing, thereby bringing more order and predictability to my behavior, while also reducing the complexity of my decision-making process. Simplifying everything makes sense, given the brain's limited processing power. The rules that I developed encompass a wide-ranging assortment of critical investment processes, including what I read and in what order when I'm researching stocks, whom I speak with and refuse to speak with about potential investments, how I deal with corporate management, how I trade stocks, and how I communicate and don't with my shareholders. Some of these rules are broadly applicable, others are more idiosyncratic and may work better for me than for you. What's more, this remains a work in progress, a game plan that I keep revising as I learn from experience what works best. Still, I'm convinced that it will help you enormously if you start thinking about your own investment processes in this structured, systematic way. Pilots internalize an explicit set of rules and procedures that guide their every action and ensure the safety of themselves and their passengers. Investors who are serious about achieving good returns without undue risk should follow their example. Why? Because in investing, as in flying, human error can be a bitch. Like so many things in my investing life, my understanding of this issue grew out of conversations with Monish. During our trip to India in 2009, I quizzed him about all manner of things, including his approach to trading stocks. It was clear that he thought through these questions in a relentlessly logical way and constructed rules that governed everything he did. For example, as we'll discuss, he had decided that he'd never put in an order to buy or sell a stock during the hours when the market is open. When I returned from that trip, I said to myself, "Guy, you're doing this all wrong." Monish is wired differently from me in many ways, including a readiness to assume more apparent risk or uncertainty than I'm willing or able to deal with emotionally. But I was determined to follow his lead in bringing this analytical rigor to my own process. Here, then, are 8 of the rules, routines, and habits that I've subsequently put in place. This isn't an exhaustive list by any means, but I hope it gives you a flavor of what I've learned so far. 1. Stop checking the stock price. When I settled in Zurich, I made a conscious decision to keep renting a Bloomberg terminal, but not to switch it on when I got to work each morning. As I've mentioned, I now keep the Bloomberg switched off for weeks on end, but this is just one aspect of my effort to detach myself from the daily noise of the marketplace. Many investors check their stock prices not only on a daily basis, but also sometimes minute by minute. There's a peculiar glitch in our brains that somehow makes us think that the stock knows we're watching it. We may even have a nagging fear that if we stop paying constant attention, something bad will happen. Maybe a big news story will sideswipe us while we're not watching, and the stock will suddenly blow up. Seeing the stock price on the monitor gives the investor a false measure of reassurance that everything is okay, that the Earth is still revolving in its usual orbit. The problem is, the constant movement of the stock price is a call to action. If I see a brightly lit ticker symbol flashing on my Bloomberg screen, it tells my irrational brain that I need to do something. If you're speculating on the latest hot biotech or internet stock, it may make some sense to follow every mad gyration. A brokerage firm issues a wildly bullish report, and your stock suddenly surges by 20% as other speculators pile in. But I'm trying to invest in a more measured way, buying stakes in companies that I'm looking to hold for years, if not indefinitely. As Buffett has said, when we invest in a business, we should be willing to own it even if the stock market were to close the next day and not reopen for 5 years. I can't switch off my monitor for 5 years because I need to approve the net asset value of my fund once a month so that I can send a monthly update to my shareholders on the value of their stake in our partnership. But if I were managing solely my own account, I'd set up a system in which I'd look at the price of my holdings only once a quarter, or possibly even once a year. As things stand, I check the price of my holdings no more than once a week. It's a wonderful release to see that your portfolio does just fine when you don't check it. For good measure, I don't have my computer or Bloomberg monitor set up to show me the price of all my holdings on one screen. If I need to check the price of a stock, I do it individually, so that I won't see the price of all my other stocks at the same time. I don't want to see all these other prices unnecessarily, and to subject myself to this barrage of calls to action. It's worth thinking a little more about the effect of all this gratuitous noise on my poor brain. Checking the stock price too frequently uses up my limited willpower, since it requires me to expend unnecessary mental energy simply resisting these calls to action. Given that my mental energy is a scarce resource, I want to direct it in more constructive ways. We also know from behavioral finance research by Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky that investors feel the pain of loss twice as acutely as the pleasure of gain, so I need to protect my brain from the emotional storm that occurs when I see that my stocks or the market are down. If there's average volatility, the market is typically up in most years over a 20-year period, but if I check it frequently, there's a much higher probability that it will be down at that particular moment. Nassim Taleb explains this in detail in his superb book, Fooled by Randomness. Why, then, put myself in a position where I may have a negative emotional reaction to this short-term drop, which sends all the wrong signals to my brain? In any case, with the type of businesses I invest in, it's not imperative to know what's going on from day to day. Virtually all my investments are in companies where the long-term outcome is all but inexorable. The company is heading in that positive direction, and it's really just a question of how long it takes. Buffett's holdings clearly possess this same precious characteristic. Indeed, he uses the word inevitable to describe the positive outcome that he ultimately expects. Consider his stake in Burlington Northern Santa Fe. There's no question that its transportation network will become more valuable as the U.S. economy grows, the country becomes more built up, and the railway industry consolidates. Plus, nobody will build a rival railway track next door, so Burlington won't be displaced. If you invest in businesses like this that are truly inexorable, it shouldn't really matter if you switch off the monitor, curl up on the sofa, and read a book. After all, Buffett didn't make billions off companies like American Express and Coca-Cola by focusing on the meaningless daily movements of the stock ticker. The rule? Check stock prices as infrequently as possible. 2. If someone tries to sell you something, don't buy it. In the early years of my New York Vortex period, my funds returns were decent and I was hurt that nobody seemed to be paying attention to me. Then I must have landed on various databases because the phone started ringing off the hook. Everybody wanted to sell me something. Brokers rang to pitch me stocks, sales reps called to sell me high-priced research systems, investment newsletter subscriptions, new phone services, and countless other products. At first, these calls seemed a measure of my success, as if all this attention put me on the map. But I soon began to see that I made lousy decisions when I bought things that salespeople were hawking to me. The problem is that my brain, and most likely your brain too, is awful at making rational decisions when confronted with a well-argued, detailed pitch from a gifted salesperson. So I adopted a simple rule that has proved extraordinarily beneficial. When people call to pitch me anything at all, I reply in as pleasant a manner as possible, "I'm sorry, but I have a rule that I don't allow myself to buy anything that's being sold to me." Aghast, salespeople counter with questions like, "But how are you going to pick the right phone service?" Sell-side equity analysts opine, "But don't you think this is a great stock?" Sometimes they're no doubt right. Logically, perhaps I should switch phone services or load up on their brilliant investment idea, but I just won't do it. I may miss out in the short term, but over a lifetime, I have no doubt that I'll benefit much more by detaching myself from people with a self-interest in getting me to buy stuff. This is a simple application of adverse selection. As Charlie Munger has joked, "All I want to know is where I'm going to die, so I'll never go there." For me, if an investment is being sold, that's a place where I certainly want to avoid going. I even apply this rule if I'm at a cocktail party and someone starts telling me about a great stock they own or a private company in which they'd like me to invest. I may listen, I may be impressed, I may even be tempted, but I won't buy it if they would gain something from my doing so. In some cases, this might not be a sales commission or any other financial benefit. It might simply be that they derive psychological validation from successfully selling their idea. Either way, this is a no-go zone for me, because the provenance of the idea is wrong, since it stems from the seller's personal agenda. As usual, Buffett knew this long before I did. For example, he has a rule never to participate in an open outcry auction. Following his lead, I've never invested in an IPO and probably never will. When a company is going public, it has all of the mind-warping sales power of Wall Street behind it. Of course, some IPOs catch the wind perfectly and soar, but the provenance is toxic, so it's safer for me to cross all IPOs off my buy list, even if this means missing out on an occasional winner. The rule? If the seller has a self-interest in me buying, I ain't buying. 3. Don't talk to management. For much the same reason, I don't want to speak with the management of the companies I'm researching. Many smart investors would disagree with me on this. For them, it's possible that regular contact with senior executives may be fruitful. Also, this promise of high-level access can be a useful marketing tool, appealing to existing shareholders and prospective investors who may not understand that talking to management has a potential downside. Heretical as this might sound, my own experience is that close contact with management is more likely to be detrimental to my investment returns. The trouble is, senior managers, particularly CEOs, tend to be highly skilled salespeople. No matter how their business is performing, they have a gift for making the listener feel optimistic about the company's prospects. This ability to win over their audience, including board members and shareholders, may be the most important talent that got them to the top of the corporate food chain. But this gift of the gab doesn't necessarily make them a dependable source of information. This isn't to say that CEOs, CFOs, and other top executives are malicious or immoral. Far be it from me to suggest anything so disrespectful. It's just that their job, their agenda, and their skills lead them to present information in a way that accentuates the positive while discounting any business problems by describing them as either temporary or solvable. They may be skewing information subconsciously without any bad intent, but it doesn't matter. Knowing my own rational limitations, I'd prefer not to expose myself to this potentially distorting influence, and it strikes me as especially dangerous for investors to allow management to help them form their first impressions of a company. I know some money managers who will do their research, then say, "I need to meet management so I can get comfortable." But who knows how management will mess with their minds? If I have to meet the CEO to understand why I should buy the stock, that's a serious warning sign. It should be clear enough from all of my other research. And if I want to assess the quality of the management, I'd rather do it in a detached and impersonal way by studying the annual reports and other public data along with news stories. It's better to observe them indirectly like this instead of venturing into their distortion field by meeting them one-on-one. In retrospect, I realized that it was observing Monish that convinced me to stop meeting with management. When we first discussed this around 2008, it was a foreign concept to me since it flew in the face of conventional wisdom, even among value investors. Now I wonder why it took me so long to understand that this simple practice cuts out a whole lot of noise. The rule? Beware of CEOs and other top management, no matter how charismatic, persuasive, and amiable they seem. Exceptions to the rule. Berkshire's chairman and CEO, Warren E. Buffett, and a small but growing minority of CEOs at companies like Fairfax Financial, Leucadia National Corporation, and Markel Insurance, who take seriously the idea of sharing what they would like to know if they were in their shareholders' shoes. 4. Gather investment research in the right order. We know from Munger's speech on the causes of human misjudgment that the first idea to enter the brain tends to be the one that sticks. As he explained, the human mind is a lot like the human egg, and the human egg has a shut-off device. When one sperm gets in, it shuts down, so the next one can't get in. The human mind has a big tendency of the same sort. If that's true, I need to be extremely careful about the order in which I gather research and explore investment ideas. I want to evaluate them from a position of strength, not weakness. If the idea comes from a salesperson, it immediately puts me in a weak position. So, as we've discussed, I simply eliminate ideas from salespeople. I don't want to allow a sell-side analyst's pitch, however well-reasoned, to be the first idea that settles insidiously inside my brain. But what if a friend or peer I respect suggests that I look at a particular stock that they think I should buy? Even hearing about an idea verbally like this isn't ideal because it's difficult for any investor to be detached and rational when a smart person tells them why something is great. So I try to stop them short and say something like, "Wow, it sounds really interesting. Let me read up on it before we talk so we can have an informed conversation about it." If I have a business relationship with the person, I can tell them, "I'd love to hear about your investment idea. Please could you send it to me in writing?" If they object and say, "Oh, but I really need to talk to you about it first," I tell them that I just can't do it. Socially, it might seem awkward to insist on getting an idea in writing first, but it's important to take as much heat and emotion as possible out of the research process. In my experience, I'm much better at filtering what I read than what I hear. Once I decide that an investment idea is promising enough for me to explore it further, I still need to be careful to do the research in the right sequence. This might not seem important to many investors, but the order in which I read the materials matters greatly, since whatever I take in first will affect me unduly. My routine is to start with the least biased and most objective sources. These are typically the company's public filings, including the annual report, 10K, 10Q, and proxy statement. These aren't perfect, but they are prepared with a good deal of care and attention, especially in the United States, and they are reviewed by lawyers. The company doesn't want to get sued, so there's an incentive to produce financial statements that investors can rely upon. The accountant's audit letter is also key. Occasionally, accountants may be under intense pressure to sign off on the accounts, overlooking any irregularities, but the auditor's letter can subtly signal that the accounts are not all that they appear to be. Reading financial statements is more of an art than a science. Even if it's not explicit, you sometimes sense that management is trying to provide less information than investors might find useful. As in poker, unconscious tells can appear even in a footnote, making you wonder if something is amiss. In the annual report, the manager